The following interview was recorded on March 12th, 2009.
And welcome back to the show, dear listener. Other comedian on this episode is a man by the name of Baratunde Rafiq Thurston. It's one hell of a name. There's actually a video on his MySpace page of a fellow comedian going on for, I'd say, about a minute and a half, just talking about how awesome the name is. I agree. But here's Baratunde himself talking about the subject.
My full name is Baratunde Rafiq Thurston. It's a long name, a lot of meaning. Baratunde is an old Nigerian name. It means one with no nickname. It's very important. Rafiq's an old Arabic name, which means really. No nickname, right? And Thurston is actually an old British name, which means property of Master Thurston. Yeah. See, some of y'all weren't expecting that last one. It's all right, neither were we.
Now, Baratunde is a very political man, very political. You know, a lot of us follow politics, but Baratunde is an actual activist, meaning he's one of those people out there who actually is getting off his ass and doing something to make things better in this world. You know, and even though the guy is, you know, he's been involved in politics for a long time, like his mom, as Baratunde said, was one of those black revolutionary people who used to make him memorize all the countries in Africa, and he said that he'd learned about apartheid by the time he was 8. And he also grew up in Washington, D.C., but it really did take him a while to realize that he could use comedy, you know, in conjunction with politics.
I mean, I wasn't like a funny kid, you know. Yeah. I was a very serious kid. I was like involved in movements, and I had a very, if you look at a lot of pictures of me as a kid, I was like very serious, I was very thoughtful. I like to think I was deep. Yeah. But maybe I just wasn't funny. What happened was there was a steady transition from like my senior year of high school, right around the time we got the internet. My school was one of the first to get the internet back in 94. And I found these list of jokes online, and it was like, they were really sick jokes. I don't think there's an appropriate context for these. There's like 100 ways to kill a baby, 100 ways to cheat on an exam, like 100 ways to microwave a cat. It was just like, but they seemed funny to like a 15, 16-year-old dude. So I became the joke guy online at our school because I would find these lists and send them out. This is before there was anything online. There was just like science papers and baby murder jokes. And I became the king of like the latter. I also, you know, as I got to college, I sort of transitioned. And I started writing for the college newspaper and went to Harvard for college. And I was really frustrated by the lack of knowledge or awareness among my classmates about what was going on in the world. I was like, we're here at like the premier educational institution in the world, and y'all don't know who the Tamil Tigers are. You don't know what's going on with the federal budget. Like, this is just stuff that would be in my brain because I was a nerd, a news nerd. So I started, as I was writing for the school paper, I started an email publication on the side called Newsflash.
What year was that?
This was 1996. The first issue came out in February. And it was N-E-W-S-P-H, Flash with a P-H, because it was fat, see, because I was dope, because I was hot. It was great. And so it was all the news that's fit to twist. And this was my way of delivering information, but making it funny and more accessible. So I sent it out over this email list, mostly of like the black kids in our class, had a little email list, about 80 kids. And then people heard about it, they were forwarding it around. So I ended up with like many hundreds of people. At the peak, I think I had like 600 or 700 people on this list.
And how old were you?
I was 18, 19, yeah, both those years. And I did this throughout college. So that's when it really became apparent. It was through writing, it was through, you know, politics and news and comedy all came together as a way to disseminate info and be more accessible. I'm like, yo, your stuff is much better than what I read in a newspaper. And I didn't even know The Onion existed. That was the other thing. The Onion went online in 96. And I found it later in college. And people were like, yo, your stuff is a lot like The Onion. I'm like, they stole that stuff from me. Obviously, they perfected it. But it was really cool to finally end up, actually work there now. And it's sort of like a homecoming back to where I started in original, my writing and comedy and news.
Yeah, Baratunde is, he's also the web editor for The Onion, the satirical newspaper. He's in charge of pretty much the Onion's entire web presence. And he's also politics editor, got brought on before the election last year because, you know, there was a hell of a lot to make fun of. Here he is telling me about an Onion story that they did online that combined the two, web and politics.
So one of the things we did, for example, we did an Obama story that involved a 3D rendering of his face. The headline was Obama Practices Looking Off into Future Pose. And one of our graphics guys knew this Flash dude, and he had developed this 3D model of Obama's face. And so, oh, you can't put this in a newspaper. You can't print in 3D yet. So, you know, online, though, you can go to this article and, like, turn his head and see this angle means such and such. And when he's at 45 degrees, that means he's optimistic about the economic future but really cautious about our military presence overseas. And it was a great – it's already a great joke, but using the technology, we could make it an even deeper kind of joke experience. I think that sounds like a Disney ride or something. I should probably be prevented from saying stuff like that. So those are the two main things, like our presence online and sort of adapting the comedy to online. Politically, it was heavily around the election. We started blogging. We created a whole bunch of blog characters. We had a fetus blogging the election. We had a high school junior blogging the election. We had a retired Vietnam torturer blogging the election. And all these were created characters, but a lot of them took people, you know, by surprise, and some of them believed that we actually had a retired Vietnam torturer, the guy who tortured John McCain, specifically. We created a character around him. So
that, from what I hear, that happens a lot at The Onion.
Yeah. Well, I think it's because we write really well. I mean, it's like one of the greatest places, most talented writers, period, who probably could write really good news stories. Not sure about the whole fact-finding part. You know, like leather, you know, shoe leather and all that stuff might not be great, but when you're creating the facts, you can do a pretty good job of it and still transmit the truth a lot of times.
This is a guy that has a hell of a lot on his plate. Like, not only is he a stand-up, not only is he the web editor and the politics editor for The Onion, but he's also the co-founder of a blog. It's called jackandjillpolitics.com.
It's a black political blog. I founded it with Cheryl Conti. She actually started it and brought me on like a month later. And it's a black political blog. It's the number 3 in terms of reach black political blog, maybe number 7 overall black blog. And it's pretty influential as far as progressive blogs go. We started it in the summer of 06 because there weren't a lot of black people talking about politics online. There were a lot of black people talking about hip-hop, talking about culture in general, but at the birth of the big sort of left-wing political conspiracy matrix, there weren't a lot of black folks prominently a part of that. And so we're like, well, let's do it. And we started it there just to editorialize about, you know, things that were of concern to black folks, the Congressional Black Caucus and the leadership within the black community. National issues, but with a focus on black people's perspective on them. So a little bit more about criminal justice, a little bit more about the inner city, a little bit more, obviously, about racism and discrimination. And it's become a bigger deal, in part because of Obama, and in part because I think we've grown in a pretty smart way. So it's like good editorial, good community, and a somewhat unique political perspective.
In recent weeks, there's been a lot of talk about the New York Post chip cartoon. It was the one where there were two police officers standing over the bloody body of a dead chimp, saying, I guess we're going to have to get someone else to write the stimulus bill. There was a lot of backlash to this. A lot of people said that it was racially motivated. The chimp represented Obama, which brought up a lot of old racial stereotypes. But really, I mean, something positive can come from something like this. You know, it's the only positive thing that can come of this is it's an opportunity to really talk about, you know, race relations in this country. Unfortunately, we usually blow it. We usually screw it up pretty badly, and no one ever really talks about it again. And of course, until someone does something stupid. But I asked Baratunde. He's one of the people that was out there. He was actually trying to introduce some sort of intelligent debate about this subject. He was on MSNBC for it, and I asked him, you know, what's the best way to approach this subject?
With violence, because then you...
Why do you hate white people?
Get to the point, and there's no beating around the bush, I don't have the right words, it's like you focus on, do I have the right stick, or should I use a foosball, or whatever. No, that's an impossible question to answer, like, in totality, but I think there are some good ways. I think a number of things have to happen if we're going to make real progress. I think one is, for a long time, the people talking about race have been the people victimized by racism, almost exclusively. So naturally, you have like black and brown people protesting, marching, complaining, filing lawsuits, being like, this is wrong. I think for the country to ultimately get to its more perfect state, we need the majority, we need white people to be as invested in legitimate and deep and honest conversation as you've had sort of the victims upset by it. And that's a hard thing. It's a big thing because you look at all these marks of progress, especially for certain individuals like an Obama, like a Colin Powell, and a lot of white people like, well, I didn't own slaves, and as a black president, ergo, what's there to talk about? But I think there's so many things left over from America's like super duper racist past that we've never fully acknowledged as a country, that it's going to involve not just people of color, but white people as well, taking a really active role and looking into kind of what happened and what continues to happen because of what happened. It's not as simple as I didn't do anything wrong, therefore there's nothing to talk about. So that's one big thing. I think as well, it'll be good to get people involved in the conversation that are not the typical spokespeople for the conversation. I think you end up turning a lot of people off when, you know, through certain people's activist past and efforts, but also through the media's own laziness, you were like, well, Sharpton speaks for black people, Jesse Jackson speaks for black people, and everything they say goes. And I think that shortchanges how complicated things are. One, because they're much older, and they bring a certain wisdom and experience, but they also bring a certain outmoded and outdatedness. You know, the way that they're going to hold the conversation is going to be different from the way like a 15-year-old would, whose world is so different. And I'm really interested in hearing what the younger people have, because ultimately the old people need to die, right? Like, it's a necessary thing. Because you can't change everything. You just need a lot of old people to just move on. And hopefully young people are developing their own new patterns of interacting with each other and can help lead this conversation. It's not always good to lead with the elder, because the elder has gone through a lot of stuff that no one in the young phase has experienced or should have to. And I think that would be a good thing if we had younger people and whiter people helping charge ahead in this racial conversation.
Well, do you think the election of Obama has made it easier for people to approach this subject? Or has it made it harder? I mean, it can go either way.
The answer is yes. It's made it harder because this phrase post-racial has become really popular. It's a dangerous phrase. I'll tell you, on the day before the inauguration, I was in D.C. on the Mall on a BBC radio program. It was a really cool show. It's called World Have Your Say. They get like 30 million. So the host is walking around the mall looking for black people to talk to. What does this day mean? Do you think the expectations are too high? That's his question. He approaches his black family, like three people, and he says, do you think that Barack Obama can fulfill all the promises he's made, that, you know, the race problem in America will actually be overcome? And she's like, yes, we made it. It's over. We did it. And I was just like, oh, Jesus, somebody please cut her mic. That is just wrong and dangerous, because it oversimplifies what the true struggle is. And all the symbolism around his inauguration was beautiful, but also a little very unrealistic and a little dangerous to say, well, everything that Martin Luther King fought for has been realized in the election of this one dude. Not true at all. Like, he was fighting for a more peaceful nation that didn't occupy 100-plus countries with his military. He was fighting for real distribution of wealth on a more equitable basis. And Obama's a good dude. The best dude running, certainly. And his symbolism is powerful. But the reality is he can only do so much. And I think his election gives a lot of excuses to people who are looking for excuses to move on, and not in a good way. So that's the downside. The upside is the response to the talk of post-racial kumbayaness is loud, and almost as loud as the eagerness on some people's part to move on and not have the conversation. So I think, you know, it's not simple, but neither is the underlying situation. So a lot of people are like, yeah, we're done, Obama's president. A lot of people are like, clearly not. Clearly there's still massive levels of police brutality and housing discrimination and dysfunctional families and drug problems that are not eradicated because this one dude is elected. So hopefully the backlash to the oversimplification is creative enough to engage the people that need to be engaged in realizing that it's not over. I hope to be a part of that. I think it's going to happen. We'll see.
You may have figured this out already, but Baratunde, he's a nerd. You know, he's a geek, a nerd American, whatever you prefer. And, you know, it definitely shows in his act. You know, it's not necessarily by what he says, but you could definitely see it by the tools that he uses.
I grew up taking apart computers and TVs, never really putting them back together, but always hacking things. I hacked my way into, like, internet access. I sent spoof emails using Yale servers when I was in high school just because I could. And so I'm not super talented technically, but I'm well above the average person who's, like, using Google to find things online. And I like testing the limits of tools. It's just fun. It gives me power, and I like having that power. What happened with me at Apple was I had a problem with my Mac computer shortly after I switched. I made the switch. I'm a Mac. I'm a PC. Blah, blah, blah. I did it. I switched. And then my Mac started acting up for no good reason. And I called Apple, and they could not help me for no good reason. And so I blogged about it. That's what I do. I bitch out loud through text. And I got all these Apple fanatics hating on me because I was criticizing their esteemed icon, Steve Jobs, and the Mac computer. And so I decided to make an act out of that situation. I took all their emails and put them up on a big screen using Apple software, using like it's kind of like PowerPoint, it's called Keynote. And I told the story of my Mac problem and of these fanatics, and I equated them to like jihadists and interspersed pictures of Al-Qaeda with Mac fans, and also used it as an opportunity to diss back on the people that were dissing me. And it went over really well. And then I posted that to YouTube. And I was like, so it was stand-up, but it was like integrated with images and text, and you know, haven't really messed with video live yet because that adds more complexity with sound and all. So, and then I went to the inauguration, and you know, I had been paid. Actually, Comedy Central hired me to Twitter my experience of the inauguration, and so I would do it anyway. But it was nice to get money on top of that, and so I had all kinds of cool observations about my experience at the inauguration. Some of it was emotional, but a lot of it was hilarious.
I want to talk quickly about inauguration. I went down there. I have a very long story, but I want to share some snippets of it because it was very insane. It was cold, a lot of people. The first thing I noticed at the transition team office, black people were showing up just asking for tickets to inauguration. They're like, I voted for Obama. I'm black. Ergo, hook a brother up. It's like, I love my people. I really, it made me so proud.
And so I was Twittering stuff like that and getting a good response. And I was like, I wonder if I can make an act out of my Twitter updates. Because Twitter is essentially a rough draft of a joke, right? A rough draft of a statement. And so I took all my tweets. I had like 200 of them. I whittled it down to like the funniest 40. And I was also taking pictures during the time. So anytime you have an image to illustrate your point, it helps. So I would talk through my inaugural experience, showing my tweets, showing photos that I took and had downloaded from Flickr, showing my Facebook messages that I've been writing with people, and got this 10-minute tight set of really, like, funny comedy. And it was different, and I don't see people doing it. So I'm all over Twitter. Like, that's basically my homepage is twitter.com/Baratunde. And so to be able to take that rough draft, edit it down, it's kind of what comics do anyway. You have to test a joke out a lot, and Twitter's the one forum to be able to do that.
Multimedia shows, great live. Great for YouTube. Radio, not quite so much, but I was able to grab a few audio clips whenever I saw Baratunde live the other night at this place called The Living Room at Postmark Cafe in Park Slope.
Now, I want to talk about Obama gave a big speech this week, and I just want to kind of review some of the things that happened and were said and were seen. Now, this is Baratunde's address to a joint session of Congress, a story told via Twitter, Facebook, and unauthorized screen captures from a variety of media organizations with large legal departments. So there were great moments in the speech, and he said things like, well, but while our economy may be weakened and our confidence shaken, though we're living through difficult and uncertain times, tonight I want every American to know this. We will rebuild. We will recover, and the United States of America will rise again. I was President Barack Obama, and I was like, I've heard that somewhere before, and I racked my mind, and I was like, I've seen that somewhere before. We will not go quietly into the night. We will not vanish without a fight. We're going to live on. We're going to survive. Today, we celebrate our Independence Day. President Thomas J. Wilborn. A.K.A. Bill Pullman. I was like, he's a plagiarist. He steals from Deval Patrick. He steals from the motion picture industry. No shame, no shame. So that was pretty exciting moments. Now, he also had some very inspiring things to say about energy. He laid out his whole energy plan, and it was kind of nice to see a president use political capital, like not to invade the wrong country or rail against animal-human hybrids. You know, it was a really bold move of his. And so he said, we invented the solar technology. We've fallen behind countries like Germany and Japan in producing a new plug-in hybrids to roll off our assembly lines, but they will run on batteries made in Korea. Well, I do not accept a future where America, the country that invented the car, you know, is not going to be leading in green technology. And I was like, yo, I am so fired up right now. I'm going to make a battery, like, right now. I'm ready to go. Fire it up. Let's do it. Let's invade something. With my battery, though. It'll be like a green invasion.
I used to be trying to reach everybody. I've been doing stand-up for 7 years now, and I've realized that you cannot reach everybody. You certainly can't be liked by everybody. And part of the journey of an artist is to find your audience and to cultivate it. So there are people who don't like Chris Rock. I don't get them, but there are people, right? There are people who don't like Jeff Foxworthy. I understand them more, but he's also mad funny. So there are people who will not like Baratunde. My goal is to speak to the people who I already am in sync with and provide a different perspective on what we believe politically. I'm talking about there's a group of engaged, intelligent, political people who are naturals for what I do, and they just need a laugh because they're so serious. You know, activists are so serious. It's like, oh, racism, oh, war, oh, disease. Like, but that stuff is funny, too. And if we can't laugh about it, then we probably can't really solve it, because part of being human is having the emotional vulnerability of comedy in your life. Then, the more challenging part is to reach people who don't agree with me. And I think I'm in a better position to do that through comedy than through some other tool, than through lecturing or running for office, for example, because those doors are automatically shut down. People are like, oh, you're a Democrat, you're a liberal, I'm not going to listen to words you say, you're a socialist. But if you're a comedian, you know, if you use humor in certain ways, then people become a little bit more open. So I'm not out to convert, like, the evangelical Obama is the Antichrist, like, let's burn France crowd. That's too much. But there are a lot of people who are libertarian, who are kind of in the middle, and who just like a good laugh. That even if you don't persuade them, they can be a part of your audience. You know, a lot of people listen to Rush Limbaugh that hate him, but they're his audience still. I've gotten really good Orson Scott Card. He's a sci-fi writer and really conservative dude. And I got one of my best press quotes from him. He was like, we may not agree politically, but when you're that funny, I can't help but laugh. And I was like, that's going on my website! The author of Ender's Game just endorsed my material. So hearing things like that gives me hope that we can find some common space, even if it's just in laughter for a few minutes or a few hours. Ultimately, I have particular activist goals as well that often overlap with the comedy.
You can find Baratunde's staggering web presence at baratunde.com. That's Baratunde. MySpace.com/Baratunde, Twitter.com/Baratunde, and JackandJoePolitics.com.